On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the red-hot social networking site for young Americans, MySpace.com. Joining me first today from New York is Saul Hansel. He covers digital media for The New York Times. Saul, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
So Rupert Murdoch pays $580 million, or maybe more, depending how you calculate it. And already here we are just 6 months or a year later, and people are saying maybe he got a bargain with MySpace.com.
That's true. The reason is, among other things, that the audience has more than doubled since then, and it has become clear to the adult world what was clear to kids even then, that this is the new way for kids to communicate with each other, express themselves, and connect to people and information and entertainment they're interested in.
So we're going to have listeners who are intimately familiar with this, maybe hours a day, and others who will never have seen it. Paint a picture for us of what MySpace looks like and how it works.
To the uninitiated, it is incredibly gaudy, almost impenetrable. The structure of MySpace is really built around one page per person. And on that page, you can describe yourself. You have a list of messages from your friends that everybody can read. You put your favorite song on that plays when people go there. You can put pictures, clips from video. And because it is a very open system, you can put backgrounds and whatever. So the thing looks like a collection of gaudy lockers from high school with all the different labels, decals, pictures, and so on it.
So one page, though, in web terms, that can be a very long page indeed with an awful lot on it. And what's the dynamic here? What's going on between pages, between people?
Well, these are, to some degree, virtual representations of people as defined by what they're interested in, who are their friends, what their friends have to say with them, and anything that they want to post. What's interesting about it is that as people surf through there and look at each other's pages, they experience their social friends, they can connect to the friends of the friends, and they also can connect to the music and videos and other things that the person is interested in posting on their pages.
And along the way, people are accumulating MySpace.com friends. They're adding, sort of giving that status within the space, and so it becomes this huge social network. And at the same time, as you say, many of its users become kind of media producers on their own, putting music and images up there, almost always images foremost of themselves.
The interesting thing is it puts your favorite movie star and your best buddy from the party last night and the girl who you just met all on the same level. And for media producers and even the creators of products, they all have to compete for your attention on a level playing field, and they're getting your loyalty.
Tell us about the history of this site, the guys who created it, and how it came to be such a big phenom, Saul.
The interesting thing is it didn't come out of Silicon Valley. It came from one guy, Chris DeWolf, who was a marketing expert. He worked for a dot-com company called xDrive, trying to make money by selling email newsletters. He worked during the dot-com bust for another email marketing company called eUniverse, selling scooters and things by mail. And at eUniverse, he saw Friendster, which was a Silicon Valley company that had created a social network, a structure to connect with your friends. He wanted basically to copy it, and they were not a big player, but he made it simple and incredibly flexible so you could do anything you want with your pages, while Friendster had a lot more rules, and MySpace just took off.
MySpace has taken off. Why is it seen as so valuable by someone like Rupert Murdoch, a big media player for decades in newspapers and television and movies? Now here's this, you know, kind of homemade-looking site, a little bit glam, but a little bit, you know, made in the homework bedroom of individuals tossing all kinds of stuff in there, intimate details about their lives and shouting out to friends. Why is that seen as so valuable to someone like Rupert Murdoch?
Well, Murdoch has never needed to be classy. Murdoch wants to make money and understands the media business. He got into the Internet in the late 90s. There wasn't a real business there. He got out quickly, and then as he saw advertising moving increasingly online, he's a little late and said, all right, we have to build up an Internet business now. And as he was looking around, he noticed MySpace's growth, and Fox has always been a youth-oriented network. Rude, grown-ups didn't always like it, but young people flocked to The Simpsons and all the other things on Fox. And he said, these are our people, these are our audience, and we know how to make money selling advertising to young people.
And right now, then, he's down in the intimate details of millions and millions of lives. There's been controversy around the site as well because of crime associated with it, Columbine-style planning going on there, a constant chatter about the sexual undertone, or not even very far under, that runs through this site. Is that a problem for Murdoch, or is that at a manageable level, given the numbers of people participating here?
It is certainly a challenge. MySpace, because it is a window onto everything that young people do, it means that the adults who did all those things when they were young but want to pretend that they don't, and certainly want to pretend their children don't, can see everything that goes on, and perhaps the sexual culture, the drug and alcohol culture, and so on, is out there and to some degree forcing a confrontation. Because it's so big, lots of bad people are there, maybe in no more or less proportion than there in society, but he has to deal with a steady stream of stories about bad people doing things. They have taken the policy up to this point that educating people on safe surfing practices is all they need to do. There may well be pressure on them to check for people's ages and put more restrictive rules on people under 18, but that hasn't happened yet.
And because it's so big, big business is now right in the middle of it. Saul Hansel, thanks very much for lifting the curtain for us on MySpace.com. Thanks for being with us.
It was great to be here. Thanks, Sam.
Saul Hansel, a reporter for The New York Times. He covers digital media. We're joined now from Berkeley, California, by Dana Boyd. She's a PhD student in the School of Information at University of California, Berkeley. She studies youth culture and how youth use social technologies like MySpace.com. Dana, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
I know you've talked tons about this. Take us to the heart of what's new and what matters here. Is this a new thing or is this an old thing? Is this like American graffiti, just that the strip where people used to tool in their cars has now moved online? Or do we have something really new here, Dana?
Well, we have a new site. We've never seen sites like this before within a youth culture. But what we're seeing on the sites is actually a pretty old set of practices. So teens use Publix. Like, they go out and they hang out with their friends. You know, my generation, we grew up hanging out at the mall, hanging out in parking lots, you know, hanging out in the neighborhood, biking around. Teens are finding their Publix online at this point. Part of it is because there's a level of culture of fear. Teens aren't allowed to go out like we had when we grew up, you know. When I was growing up in the 80s, it was common that, you know, you would be told to go out, be home by dark, be home by dinner.
Right, right.
Now, you know, that's not allowed. Parents are afraid that their kids might be abducted, raped, murdered. So they're not allowed to just go and hang out with their friends in the physical world. So what they're doing is they're creating a kind of public online, a place where they can go and gather with all their friends, and not just their closest friends, but their broader peer group, you know, paying attention to who might influence each other, you know, within the broader school, within the broader, you know, town or county that they live in. And they're paying attention to the different dynamics that are going on. They're taking their cues from their peers. So they're using this public to do the kinds of things that we've always seen, right? Hanging out, sharing, you know, media consumption, talking about their lives, etc. Except that what they're doing is with a much larger public, a kind of public that we couldn't even imagine hanging out at the park in our neighborhood.
We're joined right now from New York by Douglas Rushkoff. He is a professor at NYU's Interactive Telecommunications Program, author of Siberia, Media Virus, Playing the Future, and Get Back in the Box. Doug Rushkoff, thanks for being with us.
Hi, good to be with you.
Dana. Good. Shouting out there, not even on MySpace, and still shouting out.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, I think the big story here is the shift in the way people are using media. In other words, that we don't just consume cultural product through media, but we produce cultural product through media, and that we see media as a means of social engagement rather than just broadcasting. And that's something that it's hard for adults to get their heads around, but, you know, kids who are growing up in that space, they don't see it as foreign at all. You know, they're natives in this very interactive media space. And the funny thing to me is to look at the way adults attempt to relate to kids in that space. Either you've got, you know, traditional old-style pederasts, you know, basically chasing kids, obsessing on teens the way they always have, or you've got big business chasing these kids, you know, and trying to, you know, one giant corporate fish swallows the next one in their I think, futile efforts to chase kids on a very new terrain.
Doug, you describe this bottom-up media as one of the biggest changes we've seen along those lines in hundreds of years. Describe for us, first of all, how all the millions of individuals in this space become bottom-up producers of media.
Well, for the most part, kids are probably appropriating media more than they're creating it.
So they're grabbing music, grabbing snatches of video, throwing it into their page.
Exactly. And then defining or presenting themselves as the kind of the combination of all these different media products. So they're sort of representing themselves through what they like. But in the best cases, what you see are, you know, kids, you know, when they create web blogs or you know, online journals or put up their own photography or their own videos or their own music or even their own list of friends as a social network, they're beginning to create, to actually do something on their own. And that's both a really positive step in terms of sort of our development with regards to media, and it's a troubling step for marketers, for people who are trying to make money off these kids, because how do you make money off someone who's creating something? It's a lot trickier. So what a guy like Murdoch does is just, well, I'm just going to buy the whole space. You know, if he holds on to it for a decade or so, you know, then finally maybe he'll figure out how he can really monetize the ownership of that space.
Already they're talking about, I guess, beginning to make products and corporations personae in this space so that you could befriend a deodorant or a kind of cereal or a car on your friends list. I mean, that's really getting in there.
Right. I mean, all they want to do is what brands want to do is become part of the conversation. And they'll do that any way they can. You know, it used to be by putting a billboard up on the side of the highway so that the kids will say, oh, let's go to that fast food place, Mom. So they become part of the conversation in the car. You know, how do you become part of the conversation online? And that's really by creating these virtual characters, by creating MySpace participants who do represent the brand. And of course, there's already hundreds of fake kids out there pretending to be MySpace members, but whose memberships really exist just to, you know, talk about different companies. You know, if you have a new rock band, you know, you put up a few fake people out there to start promoting your band or pretend that they're great fans of this band in the hopes that other people will catch on.
And now a million bands are listed on MySpace.com. Dana Boyd, you're on sort of one end of this world, but really part of it. I mean, from your online presence in the manner of this generation, I know a lot about you. I know that you love Annie DeFranco, that soul exploration is a key part of who you are. I know you go through phases where you babble out thoughts for the world to see, and then you get all introspective and refuse to share. I know that spirituality and altered states are crucial to your existence. I know all that, and I've never met you. It's the kind of thing I can read about millions of people on MySpace.com. You're looking in your research at how people negotiate the presentation of themselves to unknown audiences. Is it different from when they were, you know, putting on a cardigan and splashing on cologne and, you know, driving the Chevy to the levee?
Well, we use fashion as a way of sort of signaling our participation in a lot of different cultural environments. And we assume that people will be able to interpret the kinds of cues that we put out and make sense of it. Or that, you know, adults or other populations won't even know what to make of all of the cues we put out. And so what the MySpace profiles tend to operate as is a form of digital body with all of these fashion markers, right? These moments of saying something about yourself. But it is a kind of performance, right? It's an articulation of who you think you are. And that's a person that you say is constantly changing, right? You're faced with new cultural elements, and you're trying to figure out who you are within that milieu. Even my age, right? I'm 28, but I'm still trying to figure out a lot of different dynamics, right? Like, who I listen to musically will shift over time. It will continue to do so. My priorities will shift. And so those presentations try to, you know, represent that at a given time.
Because everybody says what movies they love, what stars they love, what bands they love. So if I tell you I love Gnarls Barkley and Wolf Mother and Pink, if they can put all those together, you'll know something about me, or think you do.
Think I do, and I'll try to have something that we can have a conversation about, right? We'll sit here and we'll talk about, you know, Pink's latest album, and it's an opportunity for us to have a conversation. And that's what a lot of those signals are about, right? They're an opening line, a way of saying hello and saying, you know, let's talk, let's find a connection point. And I'll quickly learn that maybe you don't actually know that much about Pink. And we'll use that, you know, use that as a starting off point, but allowing that negotiation to happen. There's also a certain amount where it's a celebrityism, right? Like, people people are trying to put themselves really out there just to see the kinds of effects that they have. And that has to do with, again, what Doug's talking about is a new media environment, right? We have reality television. We have a notion of taking everyday citizens and putting them out into an extreme public mm-hmm. for all of the possibilities that might come about.
And instantly you'll get all kinds of response to this. People are going to be commenting on your picture, your comments, your choices, people from all over the place. I want to listen to our listeners, many of whom are on MySpace themselves. Sarah's calling from Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. What do you know?
Oh, well, I've been a member of MySpace for about 3 years. I'm 24.
Okay.
And I met my boyfriend on MySpace. And at first, it was kind of hard for my parents to accept. But now things are getting pretty serious. We might even be getting married. And it's much more accepted now, and a day doesn't go by that I don't check my MySpace page.
Sarah, do you remember what it was about your boyfriend's presence on MySpace that caught your attention?
Uh-huh.
Can you describe it on air?
Yes, I do remember. He has a formula that he went through, actually. He's kind of perfected it. What he did was he looks for the girls' pages in his area, and he picks out certain things on the page that he wants to talk to them about. I happen to have something about dark matter from science, and I really like science.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a physics major at Syracuse, so he messaged me about it, and that's how we started talking. And we became best friends, and then eventually we started to date very seriously.
Wow, and now you may be on the road to marriage. I love that story, a common interest in dark matter. How you would have found that without MySpace, I don't know.
It's kind of weird. I mean, you'd be surprised. Everything, every event that I do, I just recently graduated college. Whenever there was a party, we always did our event listing through MySpace. Pictures from parties would always be up on MySpace. And it's kind of funny. Everybody has pictures of themselves on their page, and people try and act like they're not, you know, trying to have the focus on them, but everyone spends hours taking pictures of themselves, getting it just the way they want.
Just the way they want it, and sometimes not that fully clothed.
Well, yes, some people. but again, it's just like with everything. There's going to be bad people and good people. It's a huge database. I mean, I've heard the horror stories about people, you know, getting abducted or meeting people and having sex with minors. But the thing is, you just got to be responsible with it. It's like anything else. It's up to you. It's your responsibility.
It's the world, if a virtual world. Sarah, great to hear from you. Thanks very much for your call, and good luck with that relationship. One big stripe of MySpace.com is all about music and bands. A million bands listed on MySpace. Let's listen to one, Hawthorne Heights. Here's their song, Saying Sorry. Hawthorne Heights, Saying Sorry. The band is from Dayton, Ohio. The drummer, Aaron Bucarelli, joins us right now from Charlotte, North Carolina. Aaron, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you guys get your music on MySpace.com, and why did you do it, and what's the response been?
Let's see. We put it up there as soon as MySpace started offering a music service. The response has been great. We have somewhere in the neighborhood of like 430,000 friends right now, and pretty much we use it as like an email list to stay in touch with all of our fans and sort of create a sense of community.
430,000 friends, that means they get messages from you when a new song or album comes out, if you make albums?
Yeah, anything we want to send out, we've sent out bulletins as cheesy as here are NCAA basketball brackets, check them out.
right.
We have a new song, we have a new video coming out, check it out here.
You've made a lot of friends there and developed a fan base there. Can you make money or get bookings through MySpace?
I don't know if you can. We have a traditional booking agent, and we're also on a regular record label, and we tour constantly. Whether or not a band can actually make a source of income off of MySpace, I don't really know yet, but we certainly don't
now, but you sure got well known from it. 430,000 fans is not a bad place to start jumping out of Dayton. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dana, what about, I mean, here's one band and here's one maybe soon marriage, just two faces out of this whole sea of faces. What about the quality of relationships that come out of MySpace? Is it as good as, you know, sort of flesh and blood relationships? Is it a better way to start because you get more focused on more detailed interests quickly?
Well, you see, the relationships on MySpace, by and large, are already existing types of relationships, relationships we know how to make sense of, right? Friends who happen to go to school together, fan, you know, star relationships. You know, is a fan-star relationship, you know, going to be better online? Perhaps, right? Some of the stars are actually using it as a way to converse with their fans and learn about, you know, what their fans find interesting, which is not something they normally have access to. In terms of online dating, you totally run the gamut of it, right? You have no idea what people find of value. Some of it is the physics matter. It's an opportunity to have an intellectual conversation as a first starting point. Some of it is entirely looks-based, right? People use the photos as an opportunity to find each other. For a lot of adults looking to date, they don't necessarily want to date their friends, they've already dated them. They're looking more for friends of friends. And so often MySpace is much more valuable than going out to a random bar because you have an opportunity to say, oh, actually, I sort of know who you are. You know, you're my friend's friend. And, you know, then I can actually ask the intermediary for some more, you know, additional information. So most of the time, this is not some separated site removed from society, but more part of a mediated environment, right? It just integrates in with all of the other parts. So when you see somebody on MySpace, you're often going to check out other information around about them, right? If you have friends in common, if you have interests in common, ways of sort of scouting out who they might be.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes, you know, a different way of building trust, but I can't say it's any more safe or less safe than, you know, going out and meeting somebody in a bar, right? You don't necessarily know everything about the person, mm-hmm. but you can track down some more useful information.
A mediated environment, but at the same time can be pretty wild and free like the world itself. Mike is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
Well, from a parent of a 15-year-old, it's kind of like a dream and a nightmare rolled into one. You know, you get to learn part of his world that he's a very private kid that you just wouldn't otherwise know. But then when you have that information, you know, what do you do with it?
I mean, because you can log on and kind of go to his page and see who he's talking to and what he's talking about.
Assuming, you know, initially I could, and then he set his profile to private, and it took a little little detective work to get a password. But, yeah, I mean, it's a little sneaky, but, you know, I learn more about who's having sex and taking drugs, and he's so brutally honest on this, and it amazes me, it's not just him, but his friends are way more honest on this than they would be talking to their parents.
So it's like you've got the key to his diary and you're reading it. Do you feel guilty about that, Mike, or responsible to do it?
I'm torn. At times I feel guilty. I'm totally addicted to this because now it's a window to a world that, I mean, every parent would dream of, I think. But then when you have this information, what do you do with it? I mean, do you betray this, or do you use it? It's a struggle.
Right, but it's all laid out there right in front of you and incredibly intimate and self-revelatory. Mike, thanks for calling. Doug Ruskoff, we just got a minute before the break. What do you think of? Here's Mike sort of tiptoeing through the private life, the very detailed and intimate private life of his own and millions of other teens.
Well, the Internet's always sort of served as a kind of a truth serum in that, you know, it lays bare pretty much anything it touches, whether it's the kinds of social interactions that Dana was talking about, which we realize are almost always based on something what I've been calling social currency. In other words, that you need a hook, you need something in common in order to start up a conversation with someone. Or the fact that, you know, as we've always known, you know, teens do things that we don't necessarily like, or way people feel about things. You know, go onto any website about a company or the way people feel about their job, and you'll find out, you know, you'll find out the truth about things. And I think that's both a positive thing and a scary thing.
Right now we're joined from Naperville, Illinois, by Detective Rich Wostocki. He's computer crimes investigator with the Naperville Police Department. Naperville is the fourth largest city in Illinois, roughly 140,000 people. Detective Wostocki, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're good. So how do you police MySpace.com, and why do you feel it's necessary to?
Well, since we've been starting our first investigation, which happened probably in October of 2005, I've had probably about 5 cases a month just in MySpace alone. It's where all the teenagers are going, and what they do, instead of being on the phone or being in a chat room, they go on MySpace and they blog to each other's site. And it's huge intelligence for us to keep track of, you know, crime trends and things like that. If some kids are at a party and say the house gets trashed and they're not supposed to be there in the first place, these kids are blogging to the sites and advising each other on what to say when the police come talk to them or what to say to their parents, and we capture all that information.
So what kind of crimes have you either tracked down, you know, the bad guys on or disrupted with your use of MySpace?
Well, what's been happening is because there's so many teens online in MySpace, the predators are out there too. And typically what they do is they'll have one MySpace or one screen name, and that's a 14-year-old. They'll start a conversation or relationship with another 14-year-old, and then they extrapolate all this information about the 14-year-old. And then once they keep a big file on the person that they want, they'll prey.
Yeah.
Then they'll go back to their regular MySpace account, and now they have just so much in common, where he had just befriended this 13- or 14-year-old girl thinking it was an online friend.
And has that turned into real-world problems in Naperville, or it's all just out there in the digital space?
Oh, absolutely. I belong to the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force with the Attorney General's Office, and we work collectively together, and all of us are busy with MySpace. There isn't an investigator that has not had a case in their jurisdiction on MySpace.
That is some kind of sexual exploitation that started on MySpace and grew off it.
Yes, absolutely. Recently, another police suburb of us, Burbank, Illinois, had a kid who posted that he was going to kill himself in school, and he was looking for a gun. So we tracked down, we got in contact with MySpace, and we were able to obtain an email address of his girlfriend. His girlfriend identified the kid, and the kid posted on his MySpace that he was looking for a gun to himself. We were able to secure that teenager while he was in high school, and he was in the process of buying a gun to kill himself in school.
Wow, it's as though you're almost living in their minds. Have you used MySpace postings as evidence in court, in trial, Detective?
Not yet. It hasn't come to fruition yet in any of my court cases. In Internet cases, you hardly go to court. In actual trials, because the information that we collect on these perpetrators just locks them down, and we're able to do a very concise investigation. We leave no stone unturned that identifies this subject as the predator.
Wow, that's amazing, as if it's an open mind. Let's hear from our listeners. Brian's calling from Boston. Hi, Brian, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I have to say that as a parent of a young child, I also agree with not only the prior caller from Cambridge, but also the detective in that, you know, you can use this as good intel on what your kid's doing and the friends that they're associating with. I mean, I understand that, you know, the world changes. And just as my mother could never figure out the VCR to save her life, you know, our kids are going to wind up using the Internet way more than we are. But I think we have to keep up with this, because using that kind of intel, you have to... I guess you could say you have to know when critical mass is approaching, and then you intervene. Because my biggest concern, as the child of a young one, is, you know, how can you filter out these predators? I think there needs to be a better filter on MySpace as to how young can a child be to get on, how old must they be to be able to put up pictures or put out certain types of information? Because I mean, all that stuff is just bait, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, we hear it. And Brian, thanks for your call. Doug Rushkoff, there are formal limits here, but that's pretty hard to enforce when anybody's coming on from their home computer and you can't really see who they are.
Well, yeah, and the business models of all of these internet companies is to let the users do everything for you. You know, you can't hire enough people to monitor every post. I mean,
and they don't want to.
Right. I mean, I suppose, you know, the government's probably working on some kind of word scanning program algorithm to see, you know, if certain text is more likely to be, you know, predatory than other. But realistically, no, it's having your kid walking on, you know, 1 million subways every day instead of just the one that they know how to get to school on. So, no, it's a huge it's a hugely different balance. I think what it does, though, again, the internet is exposing part of our culture that we're not proud of. But while on the one hand making it easier to catch predators of this sort, it's also demonstrating that there really is a public health issue going on here with adults obsessing on young people.
Detective Wistowski, I hear you there.
One basic thing that we cover, and it's just a basic thing that all of us as investigators and adults, we are teaching parents how to parent. And just because a parent doesn't understand it, it doesn't mean they have to ignore it. My initiative in Naperville, and we've had parent classes, I show them what's online, I show them how to navigate, and I show them how to search their own child's computers. And it goes back to the one basic thing. In MySpace, their law enforcement division, and our ICAC, and me specifically, have come together. They have met with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They know what's important at MySpace. And as investigators, it's our duty to put out this bulletin of MySpace and teach parents that they need to watch their children.
Yep.
It's not only important for them just to ignore it. You can ignore it and not understand it, and then it's too late. You would
right, but
the way I tell parents is, you wouldn't leave your kid out in the Greyhound bus station downtown Chicago, would you? And that's what they're doing when they ignore what their child's activities are online.
Doug?
Right, and that's compounded by the fact that they're living in a commercial media space. And by this, I mean, you know, television and MTV and music culture, the way it's being sold to them, where, you know, basically teen exhibitionism of one kind or another is what gets them attention. You know, whether it's marketers watching them or cool hunters watching them or adults watching them wishing they were still young like teenagers. Teenagers have become so under the lens, so focused upon as the center of our culture, that it's very difficult for them to have a healthy relationship through media or otherwise with the culture at large.
Detective Rich Wistowski in Naperville, Illinois, I want to thank you very much. I know we have to let you go, but thanks a lot for coming on with us.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Dana Boyd, let me ask you first, do you see this realm as more or less safe than the physical world? And what do you think about this idea of proactive intelligence gathering? It's almost as though in this case, the police in Naperville know about a crime before it happens. They know what someone's thinking about before it happens. Do you approve? Is that necessary? Is that invasive?
Well, first, to your first question, which is, you know, yes, it's making people exposed to a lot more information, but they're not necessarily having physical access. And the question is, when does that line happen, right? So when does the predator contact a teenager, and what are the moves you can make at that period, and what are the places where they contact them in physical spaces, right? So most of the teens that I talk to, they get messages from older men and they think it's lame and they delete them and that's the end of the story. And so you have to think, okay, what's going on with teens who are responding? And most of the teens aren't even responding to strangers that are their age. Mm-hmm. They don't want to develop those deep relationships. There's an opportunity here, and I think that the officer is right, that MySpace is actually working with police. And this is a very new thing. There's been a lot of online spaces that have occurred which are just sort of playing ostrich, right, pretending mm-hmm. nothing happens. Mm-hmm. MySpace has actually been working directly. When they need information, when police officers need information to do their job, MySpace is helping them, you know, navigate it. And that's very critical for the safety of teens that are in trouble.
But I have to say, it's really playing with my sense of civil liberties and police investigation when they're trolling in advance of a crime. That's kind of like a Minority Report. You remember the movie where they're anticipating things. They're really kind of walking around inside the minds of Americans who are incredibly self-revelatory here. I wanted to ask you, Dana, about your sense of...
I was saying there's differences about how you do it. There's certainly, if you go in and you lurk, and I'm very concerned about some of the pretending to be 14-year-olds as police officers to look, but police officers in physical space do stand around corners where teens hang out.
Yeah.
And it's important that they actually have a notion of presence there. And the way that we think about presence is having to shift, right? We're dealing with an entirely different environment. We need to protect the civil liberties, and we need you know, parents need to know that they have to give their teens some space to be themselves. Right? A parent actually said to me once that you need to give your teens roots and wings, right? Ground them, give them the tools to actually be safe and to know when to say no to things, but also give them the opportunity to fly and explore. And inevitably, that means making mistakes. So you have to have that kind of flexibility. And, you know, good police officers know this too, right? There's teen behavior that you know, just have to kind of roll your eyes at and accept. And there's teen behavior that you need to actually go and deal with really soon so that no one gets hurt.
Yeah.
And that's a balance you have to figure out in society, both online and off.
Brave new world. A lot of people want to join the conversation. Let me turn to Patricia in Washington, D.C. Hi, Patricia. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thanks
well,
for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know, Patricia?
I'd like to very much agree with what Dana just said about giving your kids roots and wings, and to disagree rather heartily with some of what Detective Wasdowski said and also with what some of the parents said, because I agree very much that you have to teach parents how to parent, but that should not mean that you teach a kid that you teach them how to search their kids, you know, private spaces.
So you think it's wrong to be sort of snooping through your child's MySpace.com profile?
I mean, there is a reason why it's called MySpace, right?
Okay, yeah.
It's my firm belief that if you're an attentive parent, you know, and if you're watching your child, if you're communicating with your child, then you won't need to snoop around your kid's computer because you'll sense what's going on anyway, you know.
So you won't be in there, but of course millions of other people may. I mean, it's isn't that something new?
I think it's very important for the police to, you know, watch these spaces. But I think if, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, this is like reading your child's diary.
Yeah.
And I think it's very disruptive for the relationship between a parent and a child because it's a bit mendacious because as a parent you're going to walk around knowing things about, you know, that are in your child's mind.
No question.
That the child doesn't know, you know. And in addition, I think this information can be really misleading because I think that psychologically, a lot of the, a large part of the function of a diary or the internet version of that is to vent, you know, fantasies, dreams.
Put on a persona.
Exactly. That expressly because you would never think of doing that in real life.
Patricia, we love hearing it. Thanks very much for calling.
I think everyone has to realize that whatever you're doing online is subject to whatever privacy agreement that you click I accept and never read. You know, wherever you're posting, whatever you're doing, chances are it's not truly private, certainly not from whatever corporation owns the server on which your data is going.
So Rupert Murdoch can read your diary, but mom and dad shouldn't. Rupert Murdoch and
yeah,
a million
and
others.
Rupert Murdoch might not care as much about you.
Yeah, yeah, he might
well,
not.
I
want to get one more call, if I may, Dana, from Statesboro, Georgia. Our time is running down, but Matthew, hi. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I found this site a few months ago surfing. It's called MySpaceDesk.com.
Yeah.
And basically what it is it's a catalog of all the people on MySpace who have died. This is suicide and also people who are in jail for murder, et cetera, et cetera.
So is it all as a result of some kind of foul play, or are these just people who may have died? We've read about MySpace memorials to the dead. Is it that kind of thing?
Well, it links to their profile, which sometimes is a memorial. But, you know, it ranges. It's been everything from somebody dying of some disease they had to actually one time I saw someone who died when they were tractor parasailing. Right. I mean, it runs the gamut.
So MySpace becoming a kind of a virtual mausoleum in this case where the profiles never die. Matthew, thanks for calling. Dana, our time is getting short. You've been thinking a lot about this. Are we liberating our human selves into a new realm somehow here? Does this move us beyond where we've been? Is it a good migration?
Well, we're living in a culture of fear where we're trapping down more and more behaviors for teens, and they're trying to make some sort of freeing space. Most of the teens that I talk to would prefer to actually hang out with their friends in physical space, and I think we need to question ourselves as to why we're stopping a lot of other behaviors that we've always had and what it is that teens desperately need that they're actually trying to make exist on MySpace. And so for me, I see MySpace as an opportunity to give them the kinds of things they don't have, but I think that we have to question our society and the level of fear that we're having where they don't have the opportunities elsewhere.
Are we permanently heading off, Doug Rushkoff, to a kind of two-tiered presence in the world? We'll have our physical presence and we'll all also have our online selves.
Probably, yes. But as Dana says, the things that we're doing online are usually serving, except for the real rote tasks that we do there, they're usually serving as substitutes for things that we're lacking in physical space. You know, there's been a huge, compression and collapse of public space. You know, public parks are replaced by malls. There's very few places where people can interact socially in the real world in a way that feels safe. And the online universe is compensating for that right now. So I would use it as both a fun alternative and as a good guide, a map to maybe some of the work we need to do here in the real world.
Compensating on a vast scale, but certainly in a different way. Douglas Rushkoff at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. Thanks very much for being with us today, Doug.
Thank you.
And Dana Boyd, we love your research topic. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dana Boyd, University of California, Berkeley, will go out with Wolf Mother playing Dimension, popular on MySpace.com. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.